Previously on Flying the Line, Frank Lorenzo demonstrates that he has no intention of working cooperatively with ALPA.
This podcast is brought to you by the Airline Pilots Association. ALPA supports its pilots through a variety of resources, including the Guide to the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. The USERA Guide focuses on common questions that arise under the Act in the context of a career in aviation while still in the military. To access the guide, visit alpa.org/resources or contact your local rep.
Welcome to the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association, a bridge from the book Flying the Line, Volume 2, by George E. Hopkins. Chapter 19, The Eastern Strike and the Fall of Lorenzo. How do you spell Pyrrhic victory, Frank? Part 1. During a 1991 interview, former B-727 Captain Wayne Dolan, a 25-year Eastern Airlines veteran, spoke about his experiences with Frank Lorenzo. Having seen his own American dream evaporate, he was making his living as an independent painting and roofing contractor. But like nearly all the last-ditch fighters against Lorenzo, Dolan radiated a kind of quiet satisfaction, despite the terrible price he paid personally. Dolan observed that he didn't have a flying job, but Lorenzo didn't have an airline either. After getting out of the Army in 1964, Dolan learned to fly in a Colorado civilian flight school, then caught the great hiring wave of the mid-1960s with Eastern. He was a loyal ALPA member throughout his career, and during the strike, willingly did any task assigned to him. In the summer of 1989, with the battle against Frank Lorenzo at its height, Dolan was philosophical. He remarked that he'll always be grateful to Eastern for giving him a chance to be an airline pilot. There's nothing he wouldn't do to save Eastern, the old Eastern, the way it was before Lorenzo. But, in his opinion, the job wasn't worth having. It was either die fighting Lorenzo or watch him kill the airline one cut at a time. As a 50-something pilot several years out of currency, Dolan's anguish was palpable. He knew his chances of ever getting another airline job were slim, and he knew ALPA was not really responsible for what happened to him. Nevertheless, he felt betrayed. Like many ex-Eastern pilots, Dolan believed ALPA's fragmentation policy should have guaranteed him a seat somewhere in the industry. ALPA President Hank Duffy commented that there is always a tendency to blame ALPA when a strike goes badly. By the summer of 1989, the strike was starting to unravel. In Duffy's mind, the Eastern pilots did everything right. They had the resources and the ultimate enemy, and they were together. For it not to be going well brings out all the residual hostility toward ALPA, because the pilots thought their union should be able to stop that from happening. In February 1989, Lorenzo rejected binding arbitration with the International Association of Machinists after 2 years of sabotaging meaningful negotiations. Walter Wallace, head of the National Mediation Board, blasted Lorenzo's refusal to negotiate fairly and asked U.S. President George Bush for a presidential emergency board to resolve the impasse. Lorenzo responded by denouncing Wallace, a Republican appointed by Dwight Eisenhower, as a shill for organized labor. The NMB, acting under its mandate to prevent strikes in the airline industry, had stalled the strike that Lorenzo wanted as long as it could. Now the machinists, Lorenzo's perennial first target in his union-busting pattern, were finally in range. Since 1928, the NMB had asked for a presidential emergency board 211 times, with no refusals from the occupant of the White House. George Bush broke the pattern. It really shouldn't have surprised anybody. At the beginning of the Bush presidency, Duffy believed a change for the better might be in the offing. Bush had made a point, publicly and most unusually, of his intention to clean up the shoddy ethical practices of the Reagan years, often referred to as the sleaze factor. Duffy hoped in vain. The Department of Transportation proved unwilling to curb Lorenzo. ALPA asked the DOT for a fitness review of Eastern on December 7, 1989. DOT head James Burnley denied the fitness review a mere 7 days later, an unusually short period of time for such an administrative action. He also used injudicious, biased language, calling ALPA irresponsible and declaring that it had unclean hands. Burnley did this at the same time he was negotiating for a job with the law firm that represented Eastern, a clear conflict of interest. The internal politics of the Republican Party also damaged ALPA's chances of getting a sympathetic hearing from the Bush administration. During his first year in office, Bush had been looking for some way to emulate his predecessor, Ronald Reagan, who during his first year had broken the air traffic controller's strike to almost universal applause, including most airline pilots. Bush, always on shaky ground with right-wing conservatives in his own party, saw backing Lorenzo as a risk-free way to enhance his popularity. If Lorenzo won, Bush could bask in the approval of his party's traditional anti-unionism. If Lorenzo lost, Bush could make pious noises about the sanctity of collective bargaining and walk away. Given the revolving door between Republican administrations and Lorenzo's business associates since 1981, Bush could hardly have done otherwise. ALPA would later document 30 top officials who had rotated between service to Bush and employment by Lorenzo. During the 1988 presidential election campaign, Lorenzo had contributed $100,000 to the Republicans. That kind of money buys a sympathetic ear. Still, George Bush's precedent-breaking failure to create a presidential emergency board was a bitter disappointment to Eastern's pilots. Who could blame them for hoping that old naval aviator Bush might do a favor for his fellow airmen? But Frank Lorenzo's cozy relationship with the Republicans doomed these hopes. George Bush would give Lorenzo the strike he wanted. At first, Eastern's pilots appear to hold all the cards. Lorenzo had made arrangements with outside mechanical contractors to service his airplanes, and he knew from experience that he could circumvent the IAM. Eastern's pilots were the key. If ALPA honored the IAM picket line, the airline would shut down. But if ALPA crossed, Lorenzo would find the machinist's action merely an annoyance. Armed with this certainty, Eastern's pilots made demands on Lorenzo. MEC Chair Jack Bavis made clear that pilots wanted four distinct things, backed by ironclad guarantees, or they would walk. First, they wanted objective, measurable actions, a business plan, from Lorenzo, one that would make Eastern a viable airline again. Second, they wanted a fence between Eastern's operations and Continental's to prevent any future asset looting. Third, the pilots wanted a contract with Lorenzo's holding company, Texas Air Corporation, not with Eastern, because they knew that a bankruptcy court could invalidate any promise that Lorenzo made to them in Eastern's name. Fourth, they wanted Eastern's operations merged into Continental's, because they knew Lorenzo was playing a corporate shell game that isolated them as union members in his non-union house. They also figured that once the two airlines were unified, they had a chance to bring the combined operation back into ALPA. On March 1st, 3 days before the strike release, Lorenzo responded to ALPA's four-point demand. He mailed to all 3,400 Eastern pilots a 15-minute video of an informal interview with him sitting relaxed on a sofa. On the surface, the talk sounded good. Lorenzo seemed to agree to their demands. But on closer analysis, Lorenzo's promises proved a sham, for he had, in every case, left himself a loophole. Past experience suggested that if a loophole existed, Lorenzo would use it. With ALPA's support, Eastern's pilots had become quite expert at financial analysis. They had hired an analyst named Farrell Coopersmith to advise them. Coopersmith, whose no-nonsense style appealed to Eastern's pilots, had conducted an extensive analysis of Lorenzo's shoddy empire, and he was convinced that if Lorenzo didn't agree to the four-point plan, ALPA could find the financial pressure points to nail him. But Lorenzo was wily. He decided to gamble that the pilots' long-standing animosity to Charlie Bryan, leader of the IAM, would prevent meaningful cooperation between the two unions. On March 2nd, Lorenzo rejected ALPA's four-point plan ultimatum. He publicly stated his belief that 800 of Eastern's 3,400 pilots would cross the IAM's picket line if ALPA's leaders were foolish enough to authorize a sympathy strike. Counting 200 management pilots plus assorted instructors from the Miami training base, Lorenzo figured he could operate a large part of his schedule for almost 10 days, just long enough to shift some of his excess continental capacity to Eastern's routes. Seeing Lorenzo operate their former routes with continental crews and equipment, he believed, would so unnerve Eastern's remaining pilots that the strike would collapse within 2 weeks. With his reputation slipping, particularly on Wall Street, Lorenzo was also counting on a quick strike victory to make him the darling of the anti-labor movement once again. It would also catapult him to the very top of the industry, placing him in command of the largest airline in the free world, without a single union to challenge his will. At midnight on March 4th, Eastern's pilots put their careers on the line. They walked out in sympathy with the IAM, and the great test began. Lorenzo seemed oblivious to the fact that most Eastern pilots hated him. His boast that 800 pilots would immediately cross picket lines proved hollow. A mere 120 of Eastern's 3,400 pilots crossed during the first week. ALPA responded furiously. The MEC chairs, meeting as the executive board on March 13th, voted for strike benefits of $2,400 per month plus a package of loans. Hank Duffy announced that the entire $37 million in ALPA's major contingency fund would be made available to defeat Lorenzo. To nail down this fight with Lorenzo once and for all, the executive board also adopted strong resolutions on fragmentation and first right of hire should Eastern go into liquidation. Ominously for pilots like Wayne Dolan, the executive board had to qualify these guarantees by noting that they would be subject to negotiation with the pilots and management of an acquiring carrier. With good solidarity, good financial support, an excellent strike organization, and popular backing that ranged across the political spectrum, Eastern's pilots should have been able to win this fight. The pilots of American Airlines, through the Allied Pilots Association, contributed $100,000 to the Eastern Pilots Welfare Fund. On March 9th, confronted with a labor solidarity he had never experienced before, Lorenzo filed for bankruptcy. Bankruptcy judges in New York had a history of cooperating with the debtor in possession, while Florida judges tended to side with creditors. Pension obligations and unpaid salaries would have given Eastern's union standing as major unsecured creditors. More dubious, Lorenzo's principal bankruptcy lawyer, Harvey Miller, had a long-standing relationship with Judge Lifland, according to Aaron Bernstein, the reporter who covered the story for Business Week. Rank-and-file Eastern pilots were probably more militant about the strike than their leadership. Almost unanimously, they figured that Lorenzo had left them no choice but to strike. Lorenzo's mismanagement of Eastern and internal harassment of employees had become legendary. The employees pinned their hopes for victory on several factors, first among them a white knight to buy out Lorenzo. However, Duffy felt that the bankruptcy court so tilted the deal against the pilots that unless Lorenzo wanted out, the airline was not for sale. So why wasn't Eastern sold? Within days of the March 9th bankruptcy filing, a suitable candidate had emerged. He was Peter Ueberroth, former commissioner of Major League Baseball. He had solid financial backing and a seasoned airline manager to run Eastern, Martin Shagrew, a former Texas Air Corporation official who, like so many others, Lorenzo had fired. He also had union support. Only Lorenzo stood in the way of a sale. Lorenzo said he was amenable to a sale. Judge Lifland said he favored it and even appointed an examiner, Washington lawyer David Shapiro, to facilitate the search for a buyer. The basic reason Lorenzo was able to sabotage a sale was because Lifland let him. Lorenzo undermined the sale to Ueberroth by his usual trick, shifty bargaining. Every time Ueberroth's negotiators thought they had a deal, Lorenzo backed off and suggested changes. Pilots had long complained about Lorenzo's negotiating tactics. Now his fellow businessmen were getting a taste. But Lorenzo's style of negotiating a sale was possible only because Judge Lifland put up with it. Delay worked to Lorenzo's advantage. Because Lifland continued to let him strip assets from Eastern, the airline was worth less to a potential buyer every day. Next time on Flying the Line, Eastern strikers call for an industry-wide suspension of service, an SOS, but Hank Duffy refuses to endorse it. Thank you for listening. This has been Chapter 19, Part 1 of Flying the Line 2 by George E. Hopkins, Copyright 2000. We hope you have enjoyed this podcast. To listen and subscribe to more in this series, please check us out online at alpa.org or find us on all major podcast platforms. Until next time, this is the Flying the Line podcast, a look into the past of the Airline Pilots Association International. Production copyright ALPA 2024, all rights reserved.